This is Cave Scott Allen of otico.com.
This is Kevin Dente.
This is John Galloway.
This is Scott Kuhn from lazycoder.com.
Hello and welcome to Herding Code. It is June 14, 2017. We're talking to Rob Ashton, and he is wearing a very dashing apron. Can you tell us about that apron?
Well, it's the official Tame Barista's uniform. We have to wear white shirts and dashing ties and an apron to keep our white shirts clean, because for some reason that's how we do things.
So you are over there with some pretty fancy gear making amazing coffee.
Yeah, so last year around this time we went to a conference in Sweden because I was jokingly asked to provide coffee at, and then I turned up with a proper set of professional gear with some professionals, and we didn't just jokingly do the coffee, we pulled off proper coffee at the conference. And the next week at NDC we were asked to come and just do it. So we repeated the same thing again just a week later with no warning whatsoever. And we're back this year doing it with slightly more preparation and therefore even more fancy gear.
So as we're talking, I'm sipping some of the best coffee I've ever had. First of all, tell me about the beans. Like, how do you select beans? What are these beans? But then in general, tell me about how you pick beans.
Well, I must admit, these beans are emergency beans because our actual desired beans are currently lost in transit between Bath and Amsterdam and Norway. But being the resourceful professionalists we are, we have managed to, at short notice, call in some favors from shops that we trust and get beans that are ready for serving at the stands. So the ones we have here are from a coffee shop called Workshop in London. And this is their pretty standard Brazilian espresso blend. And it is standard, but we actually quite like that, because while it is a standard flavored coffee, I think the effort we put into making sure we serve something consistent really shows in the difference between this and what you might get at an ordinary conference coffee, even though that might also be a Brazilian.
Okay. So, yeah, we were talking about that earlier, how you can have good beans and bad coffee, or inconsistent coffee, right?
Inconsistent coffee, I think, is my biggest bugbear. So over there, we've got precision weighing scales, and we weigh every single shot as it comes out. We weigh the coffee as it goes in to within 0.01 grams. And we also have an automatic tamper device, which is calibrated to tamp at a precise weight. In this case, 30 kilograms. I'm not sure what that is in American.
4 hogsheads or something.
And an elbow, yeah. I think.
Okay. And so you've got that, and then what about the espresso machine? Is that where, like, I guess the obvious first thing as I started to get into espresso was thinking it's all about the machine. But you're talking about before it even goes into the machine, there's a lot of other things as far as ensuring consistency.
For me, the key point of our gear is actually the coffee grinder itself. We've got an EK43, which is the big black thing you see on my stand. That's actually my home kitchen grinder. It's what I use there for my espresso needs. And I use that with my $700 espresso machine. And the quality comes from the grinder. What I couldn't do is make 1,000 coffees in a day with that setup, because my espresso machine would probably explode.
Okay. All right. So when we talked before, you said you dropped some heresy on me. You said that you are freezing your coffee beans. And everywhere on the internet will tell you that that's horrible. For some reason, for reasons, right?
With good reasons, actually. So, obviously, my grandparents probably try and freeze coffee, and this is a thing they do. And obviously, then our generation gets told you shouldn't do that because it makes them bad. They get moisture damage, and they do get moisture damage. You inherit all the smells from the freezer, and it makes your coffee taste awful. Now, if you're just buying ordinary beans in the supermarket, quite frankly, they're only as bad as they're going to get. So they're not going to get any worse by putting them in the freezer. Certainly this kind of light coffee, they will just inherit all the smells from the freezer. So coupled with this technology, I'm actually vacuum packing my beans into the freezer. And they've got to be below 17 degrees Celsius. Again, I'm not sure that is in American. But they effectively endostasis. They don't change at all. So the thing about coffee beans is age is really important. We cannot use beans that are less than a week old. They're full of CO2. You put them in the espresso machine, they gas, they bubble. You can't get extra shots out of them, so you've got to age them for a little bit first. But then as they get older, your recipes you use on the machine, how much coffee you put in, how long it takes, they change, they drift. And that's really annoying, because I want coffee in the morning without any faff. I don't want to mess around. So by freezing my beans, I'm able to capture them at a point in time and therefore use the exact same recipe every single day from the freezer. And I've got a little notepad, well, in this case now a whiteboard, with all the recipes written on it with a list of which beans are in the freezer. I just pull them out, put them in the machine, weigh them out, and they're exactly the same every single time.
So it's just everything you're saying here is just being scientific in a way of being repeatable and writing things down and...
Yeah, being really rigorous with your inputs and outputs. I mean, that's all it comes down to. I say, you know, my girlfriend can now make coffee and she knows nothing about coffee. And I think that's the crux of it, really. I can lie in bed and it's possible to have a good cup of coffee in the morning without too much effort. You know, coffee's not special. It's not... there's good coffee and there's bad coffee, and that is certainly a special coffee bean. But it shouldn't be a big, high ceremony. We quite enjoy coming to these conferences and just having a laugh with everybody as they put something in their mouth that we've given them, and they're like, whoa, what is this? And I'm like, yeah, it's pretty good, isn't it? No big deal, you know. We don't believe it should be this ridiculous ceremony, you know.
So, one last thing. When we talked before, I confess that I didn't get the whole hipster thing of pour-over coffee. And to me, like, what I like about an espresso like I'm drinking now is that it's oily and it's rich and it's, you know, and I feel like pour over is kind of like a drip coffee, right? And you're filtering out all those oils and stuff. Can you sell me on pour over being worth, like, having any value?
I kind of feel you on it, to be honest. I mean, at home, I pretty much only drink espresso despite having a really good filter grinder in my kitchen. And the main reason for this actually is A, speed, and B, that oily, rich texture. But sometimes you want to be able to taste more of the nuance of the coffee. If you've got a really good Ethiopian, for example, especially a washed one, there'll be hints there of bergamot and flowers and really rich citrusy flavors that in espresso will just come through as like a sweet citrical goop. And it's not, you want more of that. You open it up by having a weaker cup of coffee. Now, that said, a lot of pour over uses Chemex, and Chemex papers tend to pull out a lot of the oils, and you do get a kind of weird mishmash of flavors. My preference is actually Kalita. And I must admit, I also updose and use quite high temperatures to make sure I get a strong cup of coffee. If you come to our stand, you'll see that underneath our espresso machine, we've got what's called a refractometer, and we can measure the relative strength of our coffee.
Wow.
Literally, the percentage of coffee that is in the water that we have, we can tell you the exact percentage, and therefore tell you the how much you've extracted from a coffee bean. And I'll tell you that I tend to serve mine about 20% stronger than most people do their filter coffee, because I actually think that most people don't want to have a weak cup of coffee. If you go to Tim Wendelboe in town here, he's very famous for doing really good coffee, but you go have his AeroPress and your complaint will ring completely true. It's like drinking water with a bit of orange juice in it, which is really good once you've adjusted to that. But this is subjectivity,
right
in action, and we don't feel that we've been alienating people at a conference like this by serving stuff that's going to be difficult to explain, as it were.
Okay. So you mentioned AeroPress, and at home often I'll use an AeroPress. You also mentioned some pretty expensive machines that some people may not have at home for whatever reason, right? What do you recommend for somebody that just would like to up their game a bit as far as the coffee they're drinking?
I would say forget espresso. I always say forget espresso, because the gear you need to make good espresso is just too expensive. The consistency and the quality that you've got in that cup there, you cannot reproduce in a home environment unless you have the gear. Sadly, I mean, I wish it was possible. That'd be great. So if you want something like espresso, I still say the Humble Mocha Pot is my go-to. And indeed, when my grinder has broken and my espresso machine isn't workable for whatever reason, I have a hand grinder at home, the Lido 3, which is a very good hand grinder. I think it costs $150. And I will happily make a mocha pot with that. And it will be the rich, oily thing you want. You can't get consistency out of it, but it doesn't matter. You get a good cup of coffee so long as you are consistent in your actions. And that's what matters. And if you want filter, the Humble French press, I think, is still one of the greatest things you can use. We have, again, a French press underneath our espresso machine over there, and that's what we're using for our morning coffees. Because you can throw the hot water in, leave it there, go and do the things you got to do, come back later. You can leave it in there for half an hour. It's not going to get horrible. As long as you don't mix it up too much. You leave it very still and be very patient.
Okay.
But I believe that to be the most consistent way of making coffee still.
Okay. So, normally at NDC, we talk to people about code, and at the very end we say, what do you do for fun? So here we're obviously flipping that on its head. We've been talking to you about coffee this whole time. What sort of code have you been writing lately?
I've been writing the same code for the last 3.5 years now, which for me, if anyone knows me, is unusual. I'm now a full-time Erlang developer writing distributed media streaming systems. So basically on-demand encoding in the cloud and such for large enterprises and meeting their in-house needs for that. And all the front-end stuff's been written in Elm, of all things, which people always seem very surprised by because it seems like such an esoteric thing to be using if you've been to conferences like this and seen talks about it. But we've been using that production now for 18 months, and I would say I'm now an Elm developer, an Erlang developer, and that's what I am, and that's really strange to be saying. Obviously, because this being a .NET conference and...
Okay, so if I did want to learn about Elm and Erlang, where would I get started? Where do I go to?
Elm is difficult because it's still in quite an early stage of development, and every time a major version comes out, the APIs change, the demos become invalid, unfortunately. But the documentation is really good. Really, really good. I mean, that's all we've used to get started, and the demos and examples up there are updated every single version. And because Elm is so simple, there's so little to it, there's not that much to learn. Again, it's really distilled what a web app is down to. You want to render some data from some place, and occasionally change that data. That's all it allows you to do, and that's actually quite nice, very pleasant. Erlang, slightly harder. I would say I'm very lucky because I'm working with a team. We've already been through a lot of pain in learning Erlang. Best way to learn Erlang is to read Erlang. Obviously, Elixir is there and is much more user-friendly to get started with. Unfortunately, you've got the same problem in Ruby and Rails world where you've got a lot of low-quality packages lying around and not necessarily the best foundation to be building your application on, which is unfortunate. But I'd say go through Elixir and then use Erlang in production. I mean, that's perfectly reasonable as a way of learning OTP.
Awesome. All right. Well, thanks a lot. This was great talking. I'll let you run back and make some more awesome coffee.
Yeah, well, and hopefully wash my hands. If you can't see, I'm actually stained brown with my elbows.
Yep. All right. Well, thanks a lot. We'll talk to you again soon.
Thank you much.